All right, we're here for a chat, and I have got State Senator Heidi Campbell, who is running for Congress in Tennessee. And I'm very excited for this. You are our first official Tennessee guest. So, Senator, thank you for taking the time. Thanks for joining me, and how you doing?
I'm doing great. So honored to be here. I'm afraid I'm not representing the typical media you get out of Tennessee. But I won't say that I'm not representing the majority, because I think we're a little skewed here.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a great, I've got some friends in Tennessee, and we've been down that way a few times. And I love Nashville's great. I love Memphis. I love Memphis myself. I think it's wonderful. It's really cool to see more and more folks across, whether it's Missouri, Tennessee. I just got done before I interviewed with you, interviewing a guy who's running in Appalachian part of Kentucky, southeastern Kentucky. Progressive Democrats running across the board, and the message is so much louder than it was 2 years ago, and 4 years ago, and eight. You know, it's just, it's out there. So it's great, and I appreciate that that you're out there doing it.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting that you should say that, because, and I invented this word. It's anecdata. I don't think I have to explain it to you. I mean, it is what it sounds like.
I like it.
Your anecdata is comporting with my anecdata. Yeah. I spend all day on the phone talking to hundreds of people, and I am hearing people who had kind of given up on Tennessee saying that they actually feel like they have to get up and pay attention. You know, yeah. They sort of thought it was hopeless, but they're realizing that that's not an option. You know, that democracy is hard work, and they need to show up and speak up.
Yeah, there's definitely a point where I like anecdata. That's really good. Definitely going to steal that. Yeah. But there's definitely a point where, like, all of, you know, anecdotal evidence eventually is circumstantial evidence, which eventually is convincing. Right, it starts to snowball on itself at some point in time. There's a reason why enough people say the same thing over and over again, and it's not the same. It's not just one person spreading that message. It's bubbling up on its own, so it must mean, you know, something at some point in time.
I mean, I really do agree with you. I think these things happen with group dynamics, and I mean, we've heard about the tipping point, and I think we have reached a sort of tipping point here with this, and SCOTUS's decisions have been a big part of that. I mean, a lot of women have been voting with what they see as their pocketbook, although we could argue about whether or not that's really the case.
Right.
Because they thought that, that they wouldn't have to worry about Roe because it was decided law, but they are the persuasion market that's actually moving the fastest, in polling data that we're seeing across the board. I'm sure you've seen some of the polls coming out in the New York Times that are showing that Democrats are more energized, and that we're seeing a shift even in the Republican side finally. I mean, that took forever.
Yeah. It is one of those, you talk about the movement of a group like that, the group dynamic. I talk with one of my co-hosts, Sean, a lot about, Iowa is one of those states where when Iowa moves, the whole state moves, because the demographic of Iowa is pretty static, and it's like a flock of birds. And when that flock starts to move, you can't really predict what's going to come next, because it's so much energy at one time. And it's so interesting to see, the movement in such a short window, when it looked like 4 months ago, you couldn't have found somebody trying to prognosticate that was telling you good stuff about November. And now everybody who's prognosticating is kind of going, we should hold our breath,
Yeah. Well, and we've been like Lucy with the football for so long that everybody's nervous about thinking that this might actually be the moment when that's happening. And God knows there are a bazillion news cycles between now and November, right? That having been said, some of the things that have been going on lately, I think are not ADD susceptible. I think that some of these things are people realizing that our democracy is actually backsliding, that we are actually, for the very first time in our lifetimes, losing rights. which is not the way, which is un-American, you know?
So for context, can you help us understand your particular district? You know, we have folks that listen to the show kind of in all different places. So what is your district and what is it like?
So I live in Nashville, and I flipped the first state Senate seat that was flipped in over 20 years from red to blue. And that was a very hopeful thing. I worked my tail off to do it. Yeah. And it was a really hard district. I was the mayor of a small city that has a lot of purple support, and fiscal responsibility has been really important to me. And I think that resonated with a lot of people across the aisle, especially moderates. And then in the legislature, I have kind of seen the sausage get made, and mm-hmm. I've really realized in Tennessee, because we have a trifecta, and by a trifecta, I mean that the House and the Senate and the governor are all not just Republican, but in the legislature, supermajority. And just to give you some perspective on that, we have six senators in a body of 33 who are Democrats. Mm-hmm. So when I won, we went from a sedan to a minivan. You know, I mean, it's not a pretty picture. Yeah. But watching the redistricting happen this year and being a part of not being a part of it, I was really aware of you know, the fact that they were actively taking away one of our congressional seats, and they did this in Austin, Texas, a few years ago, divided Austin up into pie slices.
Yeah.
So that Austin wouldn't be represented by somebody who really, you know, sees the world the way people in Austin do. And that's what they did here. And so I am running for one of those pie slices that happens to be the, you know, the number of the Democrat that currently holds it. But that having been said, it's completely different. It's the bottom part of the southern part of Davidson County, which is where Nashville is, and added in five more counties and adds in a lot of rural areas for the purpose of taking over one of our Democratic seats. But because I have, I represent already the largest vote share in this district, and because of all the stuff that's going on in the news that we just referenced, this is actually, though it's a tough race, it's winnable. So we are fighting like hell for it. And it's been, you know, sort of a growing, it hasn't been the regular roller coaster ride that I experience usually with campaigns. It's been sort of this slowly building kind of a race where mm-hmm. we feel like we're getting more and more strength.
Yeah. I was looking at researching prior to talking with you, the district, and I was struck by it. So I was like, there's an incumbent, but the incumbent, I was like, okay, they must have redrawn this line, and then went and I was like, oh yeah, they, I mean, it's very much the, it's that Spider-Man meme of Spider-Man pointing at Spider-Man, Tennessee and Missouri, as far as what the legislature did this cycle. And they did that to us too. They did it in the second district, where they took a district that was mostly suburban and sort of city light district, and they bumped it out and added some serious rural areas to it and to make it a probably a safer Republican seat, and then shrank down the two Democrat seats in the process and made some crazy. I mean, we've got one that runs from the Mississippi River all the way into the middle of the state in Missouri, which is like a 2.5 hour drive, you mm-hmm. know, east to west, but north to south, it only is like a half an hour. I mean, it's wild what they're doing with that stuff. And they're doing it right in your backyard too.
Well, and the thing that's really interesting about that is that, I mean, Democrats have been guilty of doing that too.
Right? Oh, absolutely.
You know, I mean, this is not really a partisan thing, but at this particular point in time when we're really experiencing, I mean, I would argue that we're in the midst of a protracted insurrection.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like the insurrection is sort of this ongoing thing. It's very, very disconcerting because, you know, I feel like it's almost a binary thing. I have 9 Republicans running against me. I'm the only Democrat, and they're all, you know, running as far to the right as they possibly can. And so I have some, you know, moderate people in Nashville who I call and ask to support me. And they say, you know, I'm going to support this really moderate person because she's a friend, but if you win, I mean, if she loses in the primary, then I'll support you. And I feel like saying, I haven't said it, you know, if you vote for anybody, it doesn't even matter how nuanced anyone's opinion is at this point. If you vote for a Republican at this particular moment in time, you are just adding ballast to a monolithic agenda. I mean, there is no opportunity for nuance in any of the opinions of any Republicans right now, because they are forced to be beholden to what is fundamentally a cult. You know?
Yeah, we see what happens when, you know, Liz Cheney is a good example when and Adam Kinzinger, when nuance and opinion becomes a surface level thing that they talk about, what happens? They get attacked immediately. And they're, you know, Kinzinger's not running again. Cheney's probably going to lose. Mm-hmm. And why? Because they stood up and said, we think this is wrong. I mean, it's something as simple as we think that trying to take over the government in a violent coup is a bad thing. And you talked about that protracted insurrection. I was just talking to somebody that, you know, one thing I think that these, you know, insane groups got right when they were saying it's 1776, it kind of is. It's also, it's 1855 to 1865, and it's 1904 to 1914, and it's 1955 to 1970, and it's just been a while, right? And now we're sort of in that bubble now where there's social change and fiscal change, and there's all of these things that are occurring all at the same time, and it feels to me like folks on the left thought, and maybe this is just, maybe this is anecdata, but that 2008, right? It was like that was it. That was the moment. That was the big shift was going to happen. And then 2016 was almost this like popping of this massive bubble that just took people by surprise, because it felt like the shift had occurred, and it turned out maybe not, and that the work was left to be done. I don't know if that lands or not, if that makes sense, you know, with what you're seeing, or maybe that's just my interpretation. Hey folks, Adam Sommer here. Just wanted to remind you, you can get signed up for our Patreon. You can get links to all of our shows, information about our hosts and what we do over at heartlandpod.com. Sign up for our Patreon. You get extra episodes, extra access. You can also follow us on all the social medias, Facebook, Instagram, and of course on Twitter. We love to interact over there with @TheHeartlandPod on Twitter. Just search for us and find the three leaves. Any place you find podcasts or social media, we'll be there. Give us a rating if you can. 5 stars, really appreciate it. And now let's get back to the show.
Oh, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we have so many historians. I don't know if you ever read Heather Cox Richardson. I will send you her blog. She's phenomenal. She's just a brilliant historian, and she contextualizes, you know, what's going on a daily basis. And I think does a wonderful job of sort of distilling the news, but giving you some perspective with historical context. And this is very cyclical. And I think that's so important to understand, because, you know, we hear from people constantly that are saying, you know, God, this is crazy. This is just nuts. But when you look at it, it's actually really, I mean, it is, of course. Of course, it's crazy, but it's not
unprecedented.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is how democracies get taken over.
Right.
So, you know.
So it says on your website, and there'll be a link in the show notes for that, but it says on your website that your trademark in the state Senate is bringing compassionate and data-based leadership to the legislature. What in the hell does that mean?
Yeah, you know, it's it sounds a little like garbledygook, but it isn't, just because I'm living in a state, and you are a little bit too. I mean, I kind of, in the southern states, we all are, where science is, you know, in trouble. Yeah. And there are people here who are actively and passionately at war with science, that this came up big time during COVID.
Yeah.
And
I can't believe how much I just agreed with that sentence, that science is in trouble. Like, that's such a crazy sentence to have to say out loud. And you said it, and I was just like, yeah, it totally is.
Yeah, I know. And it really is nuts. But I grew up in a family of doctors, and I kind of look at the world. I think science is an excellent way to try and figure things out. And so I, that's why I say data-based, and then compassionate, because I live in one of the most regressive states in the country. My colleagues in the Republican Party constantly brag about the fact that we are number one for fiscal stability. And my argument is always don't conflate fiscal stability with fiscal responsibility.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we do not take care of Tennesseans. And you and I both know that if you look at the economics of that, that's just, I mean, if we're just talking about money, flat out money, it's just, it's a bad plan. And so, so the compassionate component of it is not just about, you know, feel good, woke liberalism. It's about actually intelligent and responsible fiscal management too.
And it's not sustainable, right? Long-term, if your teachers start quitting and fleeing your state, if businesses, we're having it now in Kansas City, we just had some stories about businesses that are declining to do things in the state of Missouri, and they don't want to, you know, they don't want to invest their money here because they're scared about having talented folks under 40 work for them. Because people are, you know, do I leave? Do I stay? Why would I move my family to Missouri, to Tennessee, to Kentucky, to Arkansas right now, when I can go to, you know, Minnesota, or I could maybe even Wisconsin, right? Where, yeah, it's not perfect, but it's not completely insane right now.
And the pandemic illuminated that so much in these right to work states. And we have right to work on the ballot. I mean, we are a right to work state. And, you know, that's a classic for your listeners who don't know what right to work is.
Yeah, the Missouri ones very much do.
They do.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you know, that's just a classic situation where the Republicans really are better at messaging than we are. Although being willing to be dishonest helps, but right. The right to work it sounds like a great thing. And really what it is, it's anti-worker because it means, you know, they can't unionize and they can't fight for themselves.
Yeah. It's right to work for less or right to rip off. I mean, that's, we've seen it.
Exactly.
We've had many, many billboards in this state on that particular topic.
I haven't heard
that
phrase. I will steal that right to rip off. I like that.
That's exactly you're hitting on the head that it's just anti-worker rhetoric and the fact that, you know, from a messaging standpoint, all messaging is easier if it's dishonest. It's always easier to message if it's dishonest. Always.
100%. It's so much easier, and it puts us at a disadvantage if we're, you know, feeling a moral compunction to not believe in the concept of alternative facts.
Right.
But so I mean, that's something that is non-negotiable, though. I mean, depending on why you're doing this. And, you know, inevitably that takes us to why are we in this situation to begin with? And I think we're in this situation because of greed, you know, and because, you know, we made some real mistakes in terms of allowing corporations to take control. And the Southern strategy was a big part of that, you know, so we seem to be bogged down in these ideological issues, but I think you and I both know that fundamentally that's serving a bigger cause.
Absolutely. And the combination of convenience and the interview that I just did with the fellow from Kentucky, you know, it's that risk averse nature of folks of, you know, I just want to be able to go to the store and buy the same stuff every time. I don't want to have to think about what's going on. I don't want to know where the strawberries are coming from. I don't want to know the carbon emissions necessary for me to buy, you know, a thing of blueberries in February. I don't need to know that. I just need to know that I can get the same stuff every time I go to the store so that I can make the stuff that I like and eat the things that I like and not have to worry about that. And the packages arrive and I don't have to think about that. And it just happens and it's all instant and it's all gratification immediately. And as long as that's happening, why would you stop to think about the actual, literal, actual cost of the life that you're enjoying?
Yeah. And that risk aversion has really gotten us into a situation. I mean, you know, my fundamental number one issue is the environment. The reason for that is because if we don't have a habitable planet, the rest is irrelevant.
Right.
And so, I mean, if you look at it from a Maslowian sort of perspective, going back to the regressive economy and how you lose out if you don't take care of workers, I mean, you know, you have to start out with a place to live. And, and you know, when we see these high temperatures and rolling blackouts and all of the, you know, the Colorado River drying up, I think it's too much for people to handle. And, you know, once on the Senate floor this past year, I made the horrible mistake of mentioning the words climate change because one of my colleagues just about lost his mind. He said, "You can't say those words in here. Those are trigger words for us." And I thought, wow, that is just amazing.
What a bunch of snowflakes. Not that there's many snowflakes left, but what a bunch of snowflakes.
Well, here's a grown man saying that that is a trigger, you know, and you have to, I didn't, but because it would be too long of a conversation and wouldn't work out well. But I mean, you know, boy, you have to kind of ask yourself why you can't even talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the craziest part to me is that it's so hard to find good faith debate from the Republican Party right now. A willingness to acknowledge basic factual reality and have an actual conversation based on those facts. It's just an immediate run to rhetoric and, like you mentioned, ideology that completely ignores what's right in front of their face. I mean, it was 100 degrees for like 7 days in the middle of June here. It's never 100 degrees in June in Missouri. It's 100 degrees at the end of July, usually for 2 or 3 days, maybe a week. And it's awful. And it's the same in Tennessee, right? It's humid and like insane, and there's too many rivers. So it's like, you know, it's you walk outside and it's terrible. But that's like a couple of weeks, right? And the rest of the time it's warm, it's hot, it's 89, it's, you know, 91. But it's not 102. It was nonstop back to back to back to back to back to back to back. In June.
Yeah.
How in the world does that not grab you by the throat and make you at least look at it and go, oh, this might be a problem at some point?
Yeah, because there was just an assertive propaganda campaign, by a big energy thrown towards making people believe that that wasn't true. Right. And that's, you know, I took some time early on when all this started happening because it was so absolutely mind-boggling to me right around the time that, you know, Kellyanne Conway was saying there was the Bowling Green massacre. Mm-hmm. And we had alternative. I was just like, are we living in a video game? What the hell is going on here? Mm-hmm. And so I took some time to read about the neurology of conservatives versus liberal. And, you know, I think that we really do have a situation where we're dealing with people who have a completely different neurological disposition towards the information that they're getting right now, which is, you know, more of a fight or flight fear thing that's an amygdalic response, whereas you and I have more of a cingulate gyrus response where we solve problems. Mm-hmm. And people who are going with fear and fight or flight are much more likely to want to follow a bully no matter what they say. And people like us who are going, you know, solve problems to try and figure things out are much more likely to want the truth.
Right.
And those are just two totally different approaches. And it's very, very hard for us to communicate with each other because of that. And I really admire you for doing this podcast because I think it's so important to model civility and, you know, just very, you know, sane and reasonable conversation right now because everything has gotten so hyperbolic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something I'm a trial attorney by day, right? And so I go into these sort of concocted combats, right, against other attorneys. And it's amazing how much of my personal success is built on the fact that I know how to suppress my, you know, endocrine system and the fear and the anger and the all of that stuff for the period of time when I'm questioning somebody and they don't. And so after 20 minutes of that, they will break down and they will want to fight with me and they won't be able to help themselves but fight with me. And it's kind of that same basic response that you're talking about. And very much, you're right. It does. It's actually, I joke about it with my wife because like, you know, like any spouse, sometimes you just need to shut up and listen to your significant other because they just need to talk about the issue. And it's like the number one thing we used to fight about when we were younger was just like, no matter what problem she was bringing to me, I would be like, well, did you talk to him about this or did you consider this or did you look at that? And she's just like, I just needed to tell you about it. I don't need a solution.
Right.
Like you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, and I do think we're dealing with people who are very emotional in that way towards things. And I think that that's, you know, I mean, I'm sure that you have had this conversation with lots of people. Are we going to have a civil war? Are we headed into a civil war? People talk about it all the time. One problem, of course, is that a lot of people have guns. We have more guns in this country than people. Yeah. And guess what? The people who have the guns are not us.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, those sorts of things. I mean, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But I will say that the more that we can, I mean, I do this on a regular basis, talk with people and try to really listen to people. And it's a hard work and a Sisyphean battle, but nonetheless, I do think that the more of us that make an effort to do that, the better off we'll be.
Yeah. Well, let's shift gears here to a little bit lighter. We'll close it out with some favorite things.
Okay.
All right. Number one, what is your favorite thing? This is not your first campaign. So what is your favorite thing about campaigning?
So when I was younger, I was in a band in my 20s. And
The Keep, I saw that. I did my research. Yes. Yeah.
And so to me, campaigns are like bands. And once you get the people, everybody on the right instrument and they're in the pocket.
Yeah.
It's just, it's awesome. It's really fun. And it's the team dynamic of it. And also feeling like you're doing something to make the world a better place. It's just, it feels good.
There really is nothing like playing live music with folks and knowing that everybody knows where they're at and what they're supposed to do and being able to just look at the other person and give them that, like, I'm going to go here. Look, that's like one of the best things in the world.
I can tell you play an instrument.
A little bit, yeah.
Behind you.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't play those very well. But I play. Number two is, what is the favorite thing about your district? And it could be anything. Person, place, food, right? I'm coming to your town. I'm going to spend a day on the trail with you, and you get to show me the thing. What's the thing?
I mean, my favorite thing about my district are the people, and that may sound cheesy, but we've got Vanderbilt University here. We've got some brilliant people here, and then we've got some incredible musicians, and then we have, you know, just some hometown people that I grew up with that are just really good salt of the earth people. So real Nashvillians that, you know, aren't coming here to do woo girl stuff down on Broadway are great people. So my favorite thing, it's the people.
Yeah. All right, last one. Who is your favorite famous, is it Tennessean? Do y'all call them Tennesseans? Is that the right nomenclature for that?
Yeah. It's in a very obscure one. It's a woman named Margaret Rankle. And Margaret Rankle is, she's an op-ed writer for the New York Times. And she's also a good friend of Ann Patchett's. And she's just an incredible writer and kind of gets me through this. And in terms of just having a very deep perception, she's also a naturalist. So she's my rock star Tennessean.
That's a really good one. Tennessee is one of those states that's, it's rich with just amazing names. And obviously, you know, who doesn't love Dolly Parton? She's, you know, an all-timer, I think, but that's great. So how can folks find you if they want to pitch in, whether they're around you or not, if they want to sign up and do postcards, or even if they just want to donate, how do they find your stuff?
Well, we'd love to have you. Like I said, we're a great band. We're a lot of fun to hang out with. It's voteheidicampbell.com. All of those names are spelled like they sound. And, you know, whether you're in Nashville or you're in another state, we would love to have you on board our campaign. We have people from all across the country helping out here to hang on to a congressional seat because the stakes couldn't be higher and we're fighting like hell for it.
Absolutely. Heidi Campbell running for Congress in Southern Nashville. Check it out. Links are in the show notes. Thank you very much for your time, Heidi, and best of luck out there. I look forward to talking with Representative Campbell next year from D.C.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
The Heartland Pod is a production of MidMap Media, LLC. Follow us on Twitter with @TheHeartlandPod. With email, you can reach us, heartlandpod2020@gmail.com, online with heartlandpod.com. Subscribe, and please sign up for our Patreon with patreon.com/heartlandpod. Become a podhead or an official podgressive today and unlock all of our content.
See you at the next show.